History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories, amazing stories, with the power to change your perspective right there in your midst. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we end up benefiting. One thing's for sure, we learn a lot. We're definitely educated. We're also entertained. And in the end, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm excited about the stories we're going to hear in the weeks ahead, like next week when we hear from a veteran who was part of a very small minority in World War II. In fact, only about 0.1%. 16 million Americans served in our armed forces during the war, but only 20,000 or less were Chinese American. And we're going to meet one very special Chinese American veteran next time. Today, though, you're going to hear from several voices, some still with us, some who have left us. But hopefully, together, their stories will present a mosaic of what was happening in the world 75 years ago this week. If you've ever been to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., you know how impressive and how moving that special place can be. That holds true 365 days a year, but this week was a busier week than usual around the memorial because of a series of 75th anniversary commemorations. Just in this week alone, there have been ceremonies there for the 75th anniversary of the bloody Battle of Peleliu in the Pacific, for Operation Market Garden in the Netherlands, for the Battle of Angar right next to Peleliu, and then for the Battle of the Hürtgen Forest. All of those were in progress 75 years ago today, and that doesn't even bring into play what was happening in Italy, along the Gothic Line, or what was going on throughout the massive China-Burma-India theater. All around the globe, Americans were fighting for and dying for our freedom. Let's start with the words of Major General Mark Schwartz at the National World War II Memorial this week, giving us an overview of Operation Market Garden. And as you listen, know that we're also going to hear in this hour from men who carried out the actions he's describing. You'll also hear the uninterrupted flow of the memorial's fountains in the background, and you can find links to this special ceremony at hometownheroesradio.com.
17 September, the Allies launched Operation Market Garden. They deployed airborne and armored forces with the sole objective to capture key bridges in the Netherlands that would open a route across the Rhine River and into the Third Reich's industrial complex at the time, the Ruhr Valley. This campaign was technically two operations. Operation Market was led by the British 1st Airborne Division under the ultimate leadership of Montgomery. And there were several thousand paratroopers and glidermen from the 101st Airborne Division, the 82nd Airborne Division, and the 1st Polish Parachute Brigade. They conducted their airborne infiltration more than 60 miles behind enemy lines that, you know, without really any support. Enabled by the Dutch resistance, who played a key role in the intelligence preparation and the actual execution of Operation Market Garden, from their landing zones, the paratroopers fought to capture several key crossings at Eindhoven, Nijmegen, and Arnhem, attempting to seize a very narrow corridor for the eventual follow-on in advance of the 30th Corps. The following operation, codenamed Garden, was led by the British 30th Corps and dispatched British armor and mechanized forces to link up with these paratroopers and push through across the Rhine River.
That was Major General Mark Schwartz at the World War II Memorial this week. Now let's hear about that airborne assault from one of the men who flew a one-way mission in a powerless glider behind enemy lines. We'll hear Morris Bennett explain where he was headed and how that mission unfolded.
Arnhem, Nijmegen, we had Grossbeck, and we had the 82nd Airborne is what we took in. And we didn't have enough pilots, so we didn't even have a co-pilot. And part of the equipment I had, there was a trailer with all the signal equipment, all the electronics for the communications for the whole group. So I had a trailer with that and the two people that worked with it. Some of them were shot down on the way in, but we knew it was going to be a rough mission. It was about 3 hours on tow, and we left somewhere around 7 in the morning. It was in September. We had May West, but I put an extra flak suit under my seat and went over my legs and went over my deal. And right after we hit the coast of the Rhodes, we were shot at by ground fire of barges on the bottom, and then we were shot at also by fighters. But the Spitfires came in and the P-51s came in, off defense boys, and they took those out and they took out the other deal. But I could see the tracers coming down. You see them going through the side of the tow ship and come out on down the tow line. And then by that time, they were going through ours. And that was probably the scariest mission that I had, as far as wondering if I was even going to get on the ground. But after we got over the barges and got a little further inland, we were able to land. But I was picking up ground fire after I hit the CP. And we landed about 10:30 in the morning, and paratroopers were dropping at the same time we dropped. Normally, paratroopers come in ahead of us and clear the ground before we get in, but we were on the ground at the same time that they were. First Lieutenant ran over to me, and he says, I kind of cracked up a little bit. I mean, I had to get on the ground because I was being shot at pretty heavy.
And that glider, with what it's made out of, doesn't take fire very well.
And so I landed a little bit faster than I normally would land, and it was sandy. And I nosed over, so I just knocked the nose end of it off a little bit, but the load and everything else was on the ground in good shape. I landed right by an ammunition dump. There were all kinds of ammunition and guns and everything. There were stacks of them that the Germans had got together. And I says, I think I'm okay. In other words, of course, I was kind of dusty and dirty. Of course, you got probably 30 pounds of equipment, your helmet and all the other gear and the ammunition, and your legs are full of groceries for 3 or 4 days or whatever the case would be. You have everything on you that you don't have no chance of picking nothing up. You're all ready to go. So when you landed, you got out of there. We went over to this castle, and the German officers had just left it having breakfast. Everything was still ham and eggs and everything just on the table when we landed. And so we stayed there that afternoon, and then that night they marched us downtown, and we took the bridge that crossed the Rhine, the 82nd Airborne mortar fire was hitting us pretty heavy. So they come over and said, in other words, well, you glider pilots, you are guards, you're going to be MPs. So I was an MP for 3 weeks with about 10 glider pilots, and we had over 3,000 prisoners. And we took an apple orchard that had a high deer fence around it. They couldn't come in and reinforce us or bring in any more troopers, and they tried to by air, but the weather was bad. And they made some paradrops. After paradropped it, they dropped in the German lines, and the Germans got them. And this was at Nijmegen, or the Arnhem, which is a bridge too far. There's a movie on the bridge too far. Well, this is where it was. And so about 3 weeks, we were relieved. They finally got through to us. The British came in and with the tanks and relieved us, and we went back. And I don't even remember how we ate. We didn't eat very much. In other words, I know that, because all we had was K-rations with Cracker Jack boxes. But anyway, we got back on this Army 6x6, and then while I was sitting there, like we sat on benches on that thing, and one of the guys that was with us, in other words, he didn't unload his gun or did something, and it went off in the truck bed. But in other words, none of us was hurt.
So that's one of the glider pilots from Operation Market Garden, happening 75 years ago today. Some of the paratroopers from that campaign have actually been back in the Netherlands this week, thanks to our friend Donnie Edwards and his Best Defense Foundation, which has been feeding back live videos with the vets from Holland. You'll find this video with 82nd Airborne Paratrooper Hugh Wallace at hometownheroesradio.com. He explains how he survived the daring crossing of the Wall River in a canvas rowboat on September 20th, 1944.
First, I'd say we was under the command of the British, and they was going to bring boats up for us to cross. And we didn't know there was going to be canvas rowboats till they got there. And they were supposed to bring 33, I was told, and they only brought 23, so we had to overload them. There was probably 15, 16 on our boat, yeah, something like that. They only had 4 pedals per boat. Some of the guys used the butt of the rifle to pedal, but I had one of the pedals, and I was in the back of the boat on the bridge side, and I was in the second boat from the bridge. We got about halfway across, and word came back from the front that our medic up front had been killed, some of our guys hurt. We got just a little bit further on, and I felt the boat paddle, my hand move, and there was a hole come through the boat. I was on my knees. It was below the water line. Whatever it was went right between my legs, but didn't touch me. I thought, I got to stop that water. I put one knee in, didn't do much good, and I thought I was going to put two in. I went to raise up, and I was in the water. Until this day, I don't know how I got in the water. Where I fell in, jumped in, somebody knocked me in. I had a good friend that was a little further up in the boat, but he went to the bottom, and he told us, he said, couldn't swim because I had too much weight on me. I knew I couldn't, so he says, I just started walking. When I went in, I went to the bottom, and I was pulling my gear off. I probably had 70 pounds on. I got up to the top, got my breath two or three times, and down. I was up and down two or three times. And I don't know which time it was, but when I started back down, I'd been hit now, or I don't know how much blood I'd lost. But I knew that was it. Just seemed like everything went peaceful all at once. And why? I guess it was the good Lord. I raised my head up and I saw something. I reached up and grabbed it, and it was a boat pedal, and they pulled me in another boat.
Oh, wow.
Or I wouldn't be here.
Wow.
That was Hugh Wallace of the 82nd Airborne on how he survived the crossing of the Wall River 75 years ago this week. Thanks to Donnie Edwards and his Best Defense Foundation for that. Check out the full video online. And remember when General Schwartz mentioned the Dutch resistance working with American intelligence? Well, John Cardinale was part of that intelligence apparatus. He was there with the OSS, predecessor to the CIA. He was supervising 9 different secret agents operating behind enemy lines.
While they're fighting back and forth, the Germans on one side and Allies on the other, they wanted to know how strong they were on the other side, the German. They sent us a message, so I round up Kaja, my best agent, good operator. We got underwear for German underwear, German shoes, long wool stockings with holes in them, showed that they're poor, you know. And he got her a German bike, German bottle of water, not like bottled water. We had a regular jar, like fruit jar. That was their bottle of water, round loaf of bread, hard as a rock. We didn't cut it. It was broken in half. Yeah. And I had her bite into the bread 2 or 3 times with her teeth because the Germans, the Gestapo, were pretty sharp. They were just as sharp as we are. So in case they had her come across, they would check teeth mark, check this mark, check. They knew everything. Anyway, they checked the sock and all that wool sock. Anyway, we rounded up clothing for this car. You had to go across the river with me, Rhine River, that one, the bicycle. And we had a couple blanket each, a radio. I had a radio for her, Morse key. And I had a radio myself and a blanket. She had a bicycle. And I rode her across the Rhine River like 1 in the morning, dark night, 1 in the morning. Our side were all notified. We're coming over. Didn't say who's coming, but we're coming. So don't shoot anybody going across the Rhine River. Okay, that order not to shoot it. Anyway, we went across about 1:30 in the morning, dark as hell. We reached the other side, on the German side, that's behind the enemy lines. The Rhine River is a border. And I pulled the boat up, a rubber boat, the engineers had furnished the doors. And I pulled it up about, from the little coastline there, maybe 40, 50 feet, pulled it up. And you got some bushes hid behind inside there. I went back to the coast, got branch, kind of wiped off the boat markings being dragged to where we're staying that night. Anyway, cleaned all that up, and we laid there in the boat together. Blanket was cold. And I told Kaja, I said, listen, comes daylight, I want you to go out there about 100 feet from where I'm staying on your bike. Stop, get off the bike, and make out you're fooling around with your bike or something. Fiddle around with it, you know, to show that it's broken or something. So the other bikes would go by. So if you want two bikes go by, do not join them. When you see 4 or 5, then you get up, get in your bike, and join them. So a few bikes went by. She's still there fiddling around with her bike. After a bunch came in, 4 or 5 or 6, I forgot how many there were, and she got on her bike and joined them. Now she's going down on enemy side. So the guards, I guess, knew these people going to work or somewhere. They blew a lot of face, you know, and passed her by. She had a passport and everything, you know. So they went this and she went that way, more or less. And she got herself a boarding house. She stayed there, and she started sending me messages that she's all right. Okay, so I stayed there that night, watching out what's going on, operating, sending messages back to our lines.
And where were you this whole time?
I was hiding in the boat with the bushes around me so they wouldn't see me from the highway. I was off the highway maybe 30, 40 yards, maybe, away from the highway. A lot of Army German army truck, tank, whatever, going by, troop trucks, and I radioed this back to our side. They were taking it all in. Now, I was there a few days. She took up with a German captain, I think it was, a high officer, anyway. I'll put it this way. She was shacking up with them, okay? That's her job as an agent. That's part of your job, to get information. So, but he was revealing everything to her. He was revealing everything to her, and I would send it back to our side, Allied side, and finally they went over across and got over Kaja. She was safe, and that was Kaja's mission. That was her first mission. Kaja, my best operator, I think it was, says paid her a couple $3,000. I'm not sure. Operation there was very good. We sent her back to our lines way back there. About a month or so later, we get a message. Kaja's killed. And I said, well, how come it happened? Her and some corporal army driver driving a Jeep in a side road and blew up in landmine. Not the main road. Main road is all clear of mines, you know. But the side road, they even said that. Not cleared of any landmine. It went sky high. That poor guy. She was a good operator.
And when you were talking about the Rhine and you're hiding out in the bushes, you said for about 3 days?
Something like that. I'm not sure, but quite a few days, you know, until we got information we needed.
But how nerve-wracking was that? I mean, there's Germans just crawling over the whole area. You had to be afraid they'd be discovered.
I tell you. I hate to say that, but you know the old saying, you have white shorts? My shorts were white. Anyway, it was scary. I wouldn't know John Wayne, you know, or people like that. You know, you fired an Indian, six go down with one shot. I want to talk about John Wayne. He had applied for OSS. He wanted a captain's rating right off the bat. A captain rating, back because well-known and all that. That was John Wayne. OSS said, no, you got to go through the rank like all these other guys that pay like us. He wanted a captain's rating. They wouldn't let him, so he didn't join the OSS. OSS is pretty strict.
And pretty active 75 years ago. That was OSS agent John Cardinale, who passed away 2 years ago at the age of 96. He wrote a book about his experiences, and you can link to that at hometownheroesradio.com. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we go to the other side of the world and what was happening in the Pacific 75 years ago this week. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.